time, so.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
As you can see, we've got Justice Silver in Las Vegas. I'm here in Carson City. Justice Stiglitz won't be... she will be.
Thanks, Mark.
So we've got Justice Stiglitz up here with me. And time set, we'll call up the docket. It's docket number 79094, Perez versus Talley. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, yes, and would you like to reserve any time?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Okay, go ahead and proceed.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. Micah Eccles for Appellant Cesar Perez. This is a personal injury case in which we've alleged four main categories of error, and we're asking for the relief of a new trial. The first issue we have is the Batson challenges. So our Batson argument falls really into two main categories. Number one is that the district judge did not hold a Batson hearing on the record. There's just a blank in the record at the time this was held, outside the presence even. And then the second category of our argument is, okay, even if we were to accept the judge's ability to perform a Batson challenge while the jury is already deliberating, it wasn't substantively proper. So let me go back to the first part and just talk about the substance. So this court has actually talked about not allowing a Batson challenge on the record in Brass versus State, which is a case we cited in our supplemental authorities, and another case that was cited in our main briefs that also cited the Brass versus State, which is the Buchanan versus State, for the principle that it is structural error if Batson challenges are not allowed to be made on the record. So, Your Honors, we made that argument first in our briefs because we believe it's the strongest. And also, if the court finds structural error, it doesn't need to reach the other issues, although it would be nice if the court did, so we'd have some guidance in a new trial.
Mr. Eccles, I don't recall, because, of course, Buchanan was my case, but I'm trying to remember offhand if the defense had, in that particular case, because it was criminal, objected to my holding off on the hearing.
Your Honor, my recollection of the facts of Buchanan were that it was a fair cross-section argument, so it was a little bit different than the facts of this case, and that there was supposed to be an examination of the jury commissioner. The state had, in fact, conceded that there was a problem, that it did not represent a fair cross-section. And then Your Honor, as a district judge, made the decision on the Batson challenge before the examination occurred of the jury commissioner.
What do you make of an argument that there was no objection by plaintiff's counsel in this particular instance of holding the Batson hearing on the record instead of out in the hallway?
And Judge, that's why we have two parts to our Batson challenge. I don't believe, in my reading of the Batson cases discussing structural error, that an objection was necessary. But if it was, then that's where we fall back on our Connor B. State argument on the lack of substance of a proper Batson analysis that was held later in the case. So on the Batson issue that was held later in the case, what the judge did here is we examined four different individuals that the defense had used to strike. One was Catherine Utiger, a woman who has a same-sex spouse, Victorino Ruiz, and Antonio Zuniga, who were both born in Mexico, and then Jocelyn Solano, who was born in El Salvador. Now, the problem we have with the Batson analysis is we made out our prima facie case, because all we have to do for our prima facie case is say, hey, the four individuals who are struck fall into category that are protected under Batson. And so then the burden shifts to the defense. And the defense is supposed to come up with a reason on its own. It can't be helped by the district court. It can't be helped by a later court on review. And we don't think that happened here. So we don't think the defense even gets past its burden in the second step. One of the problems, too, with the two gentlemen who were born in Mexico, the argument made by the defense was that they didn't speak English well enough. Well, that's the facts that we quoted in our brief show that they understood English just fine. There were some translations, like there was a doll that one of the gentleman's wives made for employment, and it didn't translate well. And so there were some translation issues, but also the U.S. Supreme Court in Hernandez versus New York said that saying that a prospective juror can't speak a language is really a mask for racial discrimination. And so the defense's arguments don't hold water on that issue. With regard to Jocelyn Solano, she was the one born in El Salvador. Was just that there was she was young and nobody asked her any questions. And so the way we feel that this Batson challenge ends up is a gut feeling challenge, which is improper according to the Zakur versus UT Medical Group case that we cited. And then in the last one on Catherine Utiger, she's the one with the same sex spouse. So the defense did say, hey, well, she suffered a minor brain injury at some point, which is similar to the facts of this case. Our client suffered a brain injury in this accident. And we came back, and so for the third Batson step, we came back and we wanted to argue purposeful discrimination, but the court cut us off and didn't allow us to put on our argument for the third step. And so we weren't allowed to show pretext. And so whether it's procedural or substantive, we ask the court to grant a new trial based on Batson. That's our first argument. Our second argument is the Officer Richter testimony. Officer Richter was the officer responding to the crash, but it took some time for him to reach the scene. And so what he did was he didn't have a camera. And Mr. Perez's vehicle had been moved by that point. He also testified in his deposition that he didn't know which yaw marks belonged to Mr. Perez's vehicle. The scene of the crash was near a gas station. There's a lot of traffic going in and out. And so with that backdrop, we asked the district judge, hey, Officer Richter shouldn't be able to testify at all, although he was in the middle of trial. The defense tried to treat him as an expert, but really he was a lay witness. And under Frias, you know, generally officers can testify to what they observe. They can't make conclusions based upon that. But the problem we had with Officer Richter is he didn't even know what he was looking at, and he didn't have any photographs, and so really his entire testimony was speculation. So that's our part one of Officer Richter, which the district judge rejected in an order in limine. And then we had a lengthy discussion outside the presence of the jury. I think they didn't even come in this afternoon, where we went through his entire deposition and said, okay, you know, what are we going to throw out? If we try to follow Frias the best we can, what are we going to throw out and allow him to testify only to what he observed? And so we went through that process. But during that discussion, the district judge said, I'm not sure that everyone understands what yaw marks are, so let's just use skid marks. And that was a critical error, Your Honor, because yaw marks suggest that there's some sideways movement according to the case law that we've cited. And skid marks would just be forward movement. And coupling that with Officer Richter didn't know what he was looking at because the vehicle wasn't there, he didn't have his camera. And so really the defense on liability was that our client swooped in front of him and then he was rear-ended because of his own fault. That's the essential defense position on liability. And so
I'm sorry to, and I want you to keep going, but did you object again right before his deposition was being entered, or before you started this discussion going line by line? Was there another objection following up your motion limine? And if so, where in the record?
We did, Your Honor, and this was in a trial brief. So there was the court asked for a briefing on this before we had this long hearing. And so aside from the order in limine, we also had full briefing on this from both sides. So once again, when we're talking about the proper remedy is a new trial. And I'll reserve my remaining time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hanson.
May it please the court. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Thank you for having us today. And let me just jump right in, I guess. So let me address the Batson challenges initially. So obviously the standard on appeal is whether or not there was any plain error, in my opinion. I don't believe the plaintiff properly preserved this record or preserved this issue for appeal. In fact, as I stated in my brief, the judge asked the plaintiff's counsel at trial whether they wanted a new jury. And the plaintiff's counsel stated, I'm positive I don't want a new jury. So again, this entire argument about Batson challenges was removed from the issue because the plaintiff's counsel had a chance to get a new jury and didn't. We all had the Batson challenges discussed off the record because the judge indicated that she had to hear it initially because the jury was waiting. There was a lot of delays. And so she said, I'm going to take copious notes. You guys can make your arguments to me in the hallway, and then we'll go put it on the record later. She was hoping to get it done right after that, but unfortunately, due to the trial issues and various things with the jury and so forth, we were not able to get it done until at the end after the jury went in. But at that point, we did go in, made a record, and essentially tried to summarize the arguments regarding all of the challenges that were made. And the judge again reiterated the fact that every challenge was done for a proper purpose with no racial or sexual overtones. They were done because of issues that, you know, essentially the plaintiffs or these two witnesses could not speak English.
Counsel?
Mr. Hanson, what do you make of the fact, I mean, Buchanan really says, and that was unfortunately my case, stop when there's a challenge, and here you have a judge going out in a hallway. It's not on the record. There's nothing stopped. She kept going, like you said, which, by the way, is what I did, because I had jurors out there, and she didn't stop. She didn't have a Batson hearing, which is what you're supposed to do when there's a challenge. Supreme Court has said that structural error.
Well, I understand that, you know, that I know that's been the argument that there was no hearing made, but in fact there was. It was a two-hour hearing in the hallway. I don't believe that Buchanan or any of the other cases cited indicates that a Batson challenge must be specifically on the record at the time that it's done. It does say that you're supposed to stop, you know, excuse yourself from the presence of the jury and try to hold a hearing to discover the issues and go over the three steps, which the judge did. She talked about that. And there's been no evidence from plaintiff's counsel stating that the Batson hearing was not held off the record at that time. Mr. Eccles was not present. It was Mr. Churchill and Mr. Jones from Bighorn Law that were there in the hallway, and they have not presented any evidence, affidavit or otherwise, that they were not given a full opportunity to discuss these issues on with the judge, albeit off the record.
Mr. Hanson, I understand.
Yes,
Mr. Hanson, I'm sorry. So then, just to clarify, so the hearing was held in the hallway. Did Judge Escobar rule in the hallway on those motions?
Yes, she did.
Okay. And then
make the ruling.
But then subsequently, because there was no record, she allowed the parties then to put that information on the record later in the case. Is that correct?
Correct. Correct. And that's what we did. She made a final ruling in the hallway. She went back to her office to research There was even discussion about an age discrimination change for Ms. Solano, but she later found out that there was no case law to support that. And so plaintiffs, again, resorted to the claim that this was a racial challenge because Ms. Solano was apparently born in El Salvador. That's not correct. She was not born in El Salvador. She had family members from El Salvador, but was actually born in the United States.
And there was, just so I understand, there was no objection to the process, the procedure at that point.
There was not.
Okay.
There was no objection until Mr. Eccles has now brought it up for the first time on appeal. We went forward with the Batson Challenge hearing in the hallway. Everything was decided and the arguments were made and ruled on for 2 hours we were out there. And then
what was going on in the courtroom that she couldn't use the courtroom on the record? What was going on in that courtroom that she didn't utilize her courtroom?
Well, we had an extensive jury pool out there that had been moving in and out and in and out, and she, I guess, kept
But she didn't hold the jury inside that courtroom. Presumably, she let them, you know, run around outside of the courtroom during that time.
My recollection is that the jury was still in the courtroom, but I specifically don't recall.
So if we looked at the jabs and the courtroom's empty, then what do we make of that?
Well, I don't know. The judge called us in the background and we had an extensive hearing. We discussed it and she made a ruling and she said, I'm going to go put this on the record at some point, which we tried to do earlier than that. But because of, because of various trial delays and so forth, the hearing was then not until after the jury started deliberating. But there was no objection made to this process at the time. There was no objection made to the process at the time when we put it on the record. That something was improperly stated or improperly done. There was no objection that plaintiff's counsel did not get the opportunity to go through the three-step process. And so, again, all of these arguments that they're making are after the fact made up to try to say that there was some type of structural error because the record was not made until the end. So, again, I go back to the fact that plaintiff's counsel stated, I'm positive I don't want a new jury. They didn't want a new jury. They waived these arguments, and now they're trying to come up with an argument to say they get a new trial because they were dissatisfied with the trial, how it came out by this jury. So, again, I believe that the Batson challenges have not been properly established. I believe that they have waived those, and we did, in fact, have a proper hearing. So I would request that that be denied. Now, does anybody have any more questions? Any of your honors have any more questions on that issue they may address? Okay, I'll move on to the police testimony, the officer. Our intention in bringing in the officer was not to establish the ultimate issue. Everyone knows, and it's clear case law, that the police officer cannot give a final opinion as to the ultimate cause of the accident. However, the officer can certainly testify about observations made at the scene, physical evidence, discussions with the parties, and so
but
forth.
But Mr. Hansen, what relevance does this officer have if the cars have been moved? And you're talking it's a busy intersection, then what relevance does an officer after the fact have in a case like this?
Well, there were photographs taken by my client at the scene showing where the vehicles were located, which were shown to the officer at the time of the scene. The officer also looked at the markings on the roadway where the vehicles were shown. There was debris on the roadway. There were also markings. There was leaking from the radiator of my client's vehicle. And he also spoke with witnesses. He looked at the intersection and so forth. And so, obviously, he came to some conclusions, which Ms. Talley relied on, in believing that she was not at fault for the accident. So a big issue in the case was whether or not Ms. Talley was a, quote, liar, as plaintiff's counsel used several times to the judge and before the jury, which I objected to, because of her belief that she was not at fault for causing this accident. But her belief was based a lot on the fact that Mr. Perez had pulled in front of her. It was also based on the fact that the officer's investigation revealed that there were yaw marks there, that Mr. Perez had apparently cut in front of him, and so forth. And so what we wanted to bring in is to help establish Ms. Talley's belief was based on were these physical evidences that the officer was going to testify to. That was supposed to support her interpretation of what happened. However, the plaintiff's counsel attempted to limit his testimony and went so far as suggesting that they should change the testimony, which I objected to. They were the ones that actually brought it up to the judge. And so the judge then said, well, we can't use yaw mark because it's a scientific term. we'll have to change it to a skid mark. Plaintiff's counsel suggests they call it tire marks, not nail marks. And the reason for that is because plaintiff's counsel also had various experts, Sam Terry, Mr. Perez, and also M.D. Freeman, who were going to testify about the yaw marks, and the judge excluded that information from trial because they had no foundation for it. Mr. Eccles has argued that the police officer didn't have any evidence to support his determinations about where the yaw marks were or that they were fresh. That's nonsense. He testified very clearly in his deposition that he did, in fact, see fresh yaw marks on the street that were made in the appropriate area where Mr. Perez's vehicle was located. And he didn't have his camera because it wasn't working, but he did note it very clearly in the police report and also in his deposition testimony. He stated he saw them, and he also saw them based on photographs that Ms. Talley took at the scene of the accident, which he saw and viewed while he was there with his investigation. So we wanted to give the jury some information about what was seen at the accident, not who was at fault, but what was seen. And so this is what we're trying to do, but plaintiff's counsel objected to nearly everything that the officer said. And so essentially what we had was the officer saying, I saw skid marks, and that was it. There was no context for the skid marks. There was no context for what that meant. There was no context for who they were made by, because that was all excluded by the judge based on this unworkable claim that the officer was simply a lay witness. So, again, this conduct and this error that they're claiming caused them a need for a new trial was caused and sanctioned by plaintiff's counsel by creating the issue. The third issue is the allegation of jury misconduct. They're claiming that one of the jurors apparently said that no gay person deserves any money. Now, this is double hearsay or triple hearsay. Again, it's not supported by any affidavit of the juror that apparently said it. It's not supported by the juror who allegedly heard it. And it's only claimed now by the plaintiff's counsel, who says this is what this juror told me they heard. Now, plaintiff's counsel has a history of misrepresenting the facts. They, in fact, misrepresented the facts about what I apparently said in this claim that I committed attorney misconduct. That was totally false, what they stated. They also stated in a brief in on page early on in the trial about our expert, our medical expert. They tried to claim that our medical expert indicated that it was a minor impact case, and I said that's false. What he said was it's a minor trauma, not a minor impact. And so, again, they were exposed as switching the facts, switching the information subtly, but enough to make a pretty substantial change in the testimony. So what we have to base this alleged conduct, jury misconduct on, is the double, triple hearsay statements of plaintiff's counsel about one juror apparently saying that gay people don't deserve any money. That is completely without merit. It was completely vetted in the early voir dire of all these jurors. Everyone was questioned extensively with this 451 question jury voir dire questionnaire that was untimely, and a lot of the questions were objected to, but we went through them painstakingly to ask questions about sexual orientation, about nationality, about all of these issues that plaintiff's counsel said that we couldn't even talk about. They even violated a motion in limine, motion limine number two, that the judge granted, or was it number four? I'm sorry. Motion limine number four, it said that we could not discuss the nationality of Mr. Perez, but yet plaintiff's counsel violated that by continually referring to his nationality and making it an issue in the case when we were not allowed to talk about it. Fourth, the final is the alleged jury or the attorney misconduct. They claimed that I had somehow violated an order by bringing up this CC symbol on a medical record. Now, the records, again, were admitted into evidence. They were prepared by the plaintiff. We stipulated them into evidence, and that specific exhibit was a record from Dr. Cabins, which was used a number of times during the entire trial. It was used in opening statement. It was used during cross-examination of doctors, of witnesses, of Mr. Perez himself, because it showed numerous inconsistencies in what he was saying about whether his injuries were there, whether he could work, whether he hit his head, which was a major issue in the case, and so forth. It was a very key record that was shown to the jury multiple times. And his counsel says, I violated the order by claiming that I talked about jury or attorney buildup or medical buildup, which the order that they're talking about, order number six, in motion in limine number six, was deferred by the judge. It was never granted. It was deferred, stating that the judge said, we'll take this item by item when you object. And again, they never objected. This is a pattern. They continue to assert that I engaged in misconduct, and even in Mr. Eccles stating in his reply brief that I was engaging in misconduct by showing all of the misconduct by plaintiff's counsel. The fact is, I didn't commit misconduct. The judge found that I didn't commit misconduct. But what I was pointing out is that over and over and over again, plaintiff's counsel attempted to improperly state the law, improperly state the facts, misrepresent the hearing or the motions, the rulings, and so forth, which I continuously objected to and was continuously sustained by the judge time and time again. And I pointed out just a small portion of those in the brief. So there was no attorney misconduct by myself. It did not affect the trial. There's no evidence from any jurors, any affidavits that this affected the trial. It's all, again, speculation by plaintiff's counsel, which they didn't even include in their affidavit. It was only brought up in their brief. So, again, Your Honors, to conclude, there is no Batson challenge violation. We held a proper hearing. Plaintiff was given every opportunity to request a new trial or a new jury and did not. They waived it, and they didn't object to the process and the proceedings going forward. There was no jury misconduct. There was no attorney misconduct. And the issue regarding the police officer's testimony was created and sanctioned by plaintiff's counsel himself. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hanson. Mr. Eccles? I think you're muted.
Sorry about that.
There you go.
I'll go ahead and address the arguments in the same order presented by the defense. So on the Batson issue, I know we heard from counsel about the procedure and there being a waiver. But one thing we did not hear from him is he didn't object to the substantive issue, particularly on the last Batson challenge where we didn't have a chance to put on our pretext argument. And so if the later Batson hearing actually mirrored the earlier challenge that was held off the record, then we have a substantive issue with Batson. Now, on the procedural part of Batson, our reading of the cases, and we don't really see a lot of a treatment of the cases in the answering brief. They kind of just argue a lot. They ignore a lot of our authorities. And we've put Bates versus Chronister and NRAP 31D in our reply brief. But really the issue that we have is the requirement to hold a proper Batson challenge is placed upon the judge. It's one of these kind of issues like verdict forms, for example, in Allstate versus Miller, and I think Allstate cited to Skender, where the court says, hey, you know, it's the district court's responsibility to do certain things, not counsel's responsibility to object. And that's the entire nature of structural error. It's kind of like a subject matter jurisdiction, for example. It's not waivable. Once there's a violation of a structural error, then, you know, that's the new trial. And that's all I want to say about that one. On Officer Richter, see, there is a problem with what is being stated here, because on it's true that he did not have a camera. Now, we don't know exactly what Ms. Talley took pictures of. She's not trained in any type of accident reconstruction. We don't know what her pictures were of. We weren't at the scene, and if you look in the police report, one part the court did exclude was a long discussion that she had with Officer Richter. And so he was there observing her side of the story alone.
Are you contesting that he actually didn't observe the what he termed yaw marks and make the detailed notes that were represented?
What our contention is, Your Honor, is that he was very confused about what he was looking at. He took notes. He was deposed. He talked about things, but he didn't know what he was looking at because he didn't have the vehicles and he didn't have the placement of the vehicles. On concealed bias, one thing we don't hear from counsel is the judge's own observations. When we were in the new trial hearing, I said, Judge, Your Honor, herself observed jurors talking about the concealed bias. And I mistakenly referenced that it was in open court, and she says, no, it was back in the jury room. And so aside from the juror affidavits, we've presented two of them from the two trial counsel, the court's own observation is its independent grounds for evidence which in the statute says it can be any evidence. Juror affidavits are not per se disallowable. There are certain restrictions the court has put on them. And we think there's enough information in the juror affidavits. The district judge should have had either an evidentiary hearing at a minimum, or it provides the basis for a new trial. And then on the last argument, on the misconduct argument, if you look at the screenshot that we put on in our motion for new trial, it's also referenced in our briefing before this court, it was actually order in limine number 7 that we're talking about, that says the defense was not allowed to talk about when Mr. Perez retained counsel. And so that's the order that he violated. That's the BMW versus Roth argument that we're talking about. Now, there was no objection, and we talked about that with the district judge, with this court. But our argument was that nobody ever made the determination, was it misconduct or not, before directly going to waiver. And the reason there wasn't an objection is because it was highlighted, as the court can see from the screenshot, shown to the jury, and then in the affidavits, actually shown to cause prejudice, and that's the standard under Rule 59A. And if there's no other questions, that's all I have, Your Honors.
I have one more question. Justice Perigree, if I may ask one other one.
Yes, of course.
Mr. Eccles, I just kind of want clarification if it's in the record or not. So we had a case, State versus Turner, last year, which I authored. And in that particular case, there was an objection to a confession coming into evidence, the defendant's confession. The defense originally objected to it. And then the defense went through line by line, and they kind of went through the confession. Very similar to what we're talking to here on this traffic accident. Not the traffic accident report, but the deposition testimony of this officer. So here, there's a motion in limine, and when I look at the motion in limine, it just says to keep out the officer's report. It doesn't say officer's testimony, it just says the report. And then you're saying that there's a trial exhibit prior to the introduction of the deposition testimony, and that you again object as to the deposition testimony. And my question is there something in the record that would show us that there was an objection again before going line by line through the deposition and allowing parts of it in? Because in the Turner case, we said, look, it's waived. You know, a lot of times people say, well, we generally object, but then once the judge goes through something line by line, they allow it in. So in that case, the court said, unless there's a specific objection, it's almost a waiver if you go through something line by line and allow that to go in. Does that make sense, what I'm asking?
Yes, Your Honor. So I came into the case on the day when we actually were going through line by line of Officer Richter's deposition testimony. But I did review the plaintiff's trial brief on Officer Richter, and I found the record site for that. It's in appellant's appendix at volume 26, and then it's pages 6010 through 6053. And my recollection, Judge, and I can file a supplement if the court would like, but my recollection is that the day before I got there with Mr. Jones and Mr. Churchill were the plaintiff's trial counsel, that they objected to Officer Richter's testimony in general coming in, but then with the court's threshold determination, no, it's coming in. Okay, now we're into the argument of what's the scope of that. And it that may be reflected in our trial brief, although I'm not 100% certain. But when I joined the case at that juncture, that was my understanding, is that we didn't want his testimony, but since the judge made that threshold determination, now we're into this line-by-line determination. We didn't make it through the entire deposition on that day that I was there. We put an awful lot of objections on the record that day from both sides. And then it was taking a long time because we're going into the evidence code on almost every line of the depo. And then that's when the judge says, okay, I have kind of a framework that I'm dealing with, and so I'm going to go finish the rest of these, and I'll just announce to you tomorrow what they are. But that's my recollection of how that all went down. And there, the answer that Your Honor is seeking may be in that trial brief. And if the court would like, I can find the record site from the hearing before the day I got there.
I would like that record site. So if the court, if you guys wouldn't mind, and I don't mind Mr. Hansen providing it as well or both, whatever. But I think that's important on that objection.
Your Honor, if I may,
thank you, Judge.
This is Jonathan. The discussions regarding Officer Churchill's deposition, Officer Churchill, Officer Richter's deposition were in appendix is this. Appendix volume 30, pages 6685 through 6689 or so. It's there's discussion. I'm asking on 6687, are we reading the deposition of Officer Richter? The court, we can, but it has to be exactly what we just went through, and it can't be asked by the attorney who asked the question during the deposition. And then she's asking if there's any objection, because then we go through, Mr. Jones said, but remember, you're going to read the questions that you recognize, the ones that you basically are going to read. Mr. Jones says, yes, Your Honor. I say yes. All right, so Mr. Jones then says, I want to make sure that Jonathan and I are perfectly in sync, and then maybe we can make a second copy. So we're talking about the issues that we had just gone over with the judge, line by line, to determine what was going to be introduced. Everyone agreed at that point, but even the judge specifically said, I understand, Mr. Hansen, you have a lot of objections to this, but this is what we're going
I think we're getting a little far afield. I think, Justice Silver, if each party can provide any citations pertinent to this issue, that would be helpful. And if the sooner you can do that, the sooner I think we can reach the issue.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay, good.
Colleagues, any other questions?
No, thank you.
All right, very good. Mr. Hansen, Mr. Eccles, thank you for your arguments and being here today with us. This matter will stand submitted, and the court will stand in.